Welcome to Healthy Her, the podcast designed to inspire women to lead lives filled with health and happiness. I'm Dr. Amy Brenner, your host, discussing nutrition, hormones, aesthetics, sexual health, and more. Join us each week as we dive into feeling better, looking better, and living better. Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of Healthy Her. This is an episode you're not going to want to miss because we're going to talk about probably the most popular medication around. And today we have Dr. Carrie Reller, who is the owner of Clearwater Family Medicine and Allergy in Clearwater, Florida. She specializes in obesity medicine, helping patients make lifestyle changes to prevent chronic disease, improve mobility, and live healthier and more an active life. So welcome, Dr. Reller.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here today and share everything I can with you.
Yeah. So can you give people maybe a little bit about your background of how you've made obesity medicine kind of one of your main focuses?
Sure. And it's kind of a long story, so I'll try to make it short, meaning that when I was in medical school and residency, I had initially wanted to go into sports medicine from family medicine. And I took a turn in my path because my father is an allergist and he's like, just come home and, you know, learn everything I do. And so I did that. I didn't end up going to sports medicine, but in sports medicine and during residency, I always was a big proponent of lifestyle modifications. I even did like a study on how physicians, you know, kind of do we practice what we preach, right? We talk about lifestyle modifications, meaning, you know, exercise and watching what you're eating. And then, but do we actually do it? So I've always been interested in that. And then I moved back to Florida and because I trained in Maryland, kind of learned everything allergy and asthma, and then started my own family medicine practice and realized, you know, after seeing all these patients with chronic diseases and just boom, here's a medicine, boom, here's a medicine. I'm like, something is missing here. And, you know, kind of like a lot of people are realizing, we're trying to look for, you know, the root cause of the disease rather than, you know, just giving them a medication for something. So it was actually during the pandemic when I came across obesity medicine. And obesity medicine is, you know, it's a treating another chronic disease. And while I still really focus on lifestyle medicine, and I know we're going to talk about treating it with a medication, which sounds totally opposite of what, you know, I want to do, but I'm not a person who just dishes it out anyway. Like, I'm really trying to get people to do things that if they haven't tried before, you know, lifestyle things too. So finding obesity medicine allowed me to kind of really understand like the neurobehavioral biological process of having excess weight, which I had no idea it was so much more involved than it is. So it really gives you an understanding, and also the biopsychosocial approach of it as well. So it's not as simple as we think. Like, it is a chronic disease. The Obesity Medicine Association, like, has a definition that it's a chronic, progressive, relapsing neurobehavioral disease, that excess weight that causes, you know, other metabolic and other problems. So I do believe it is a disease and it has to be managed as such. So during the pandemic, I found it and then I started kind of implementing everything I've learned into my practice. And now I, you know, I do still do primary care, but I'm always on that verge of, you know, how can we make things better? What one thing of your habits can we change to, you know, not need as much medicine, that kind of thing. Yeah.
So you are originally board certified in family medicine, is that right?
Yes.
So I'm originally a OBGYN, and you mentioned that obesity is its own chronic disease, but obesity or being overweight leads to, or can lead to, a lot of other chronic diseases just from being overweight and obese. And in my field of gynecology, you know, some of the other diseases that obesity can lead to is endometrial cancer or endometrial hyperplasia associated with PCOS. It's kind of like the chicken or the egg there of which comes first. Breast cancer, irregular bleeding, infertility. Those are the things I can think of from a gynecology standpoint that obesity can lead to. Can you just, for our listeners, explain what chronic diseases, even though obesity is its own disease, mm-hmm. but what diseases does that predispose you or lead to as a family medicine provider?
Sure. Well, you mentioned a lot of good ones. Obviously, we do think of PCOS on a spectrum of insulin resistance. And on that spectrum, we think of diabetes and prediabetes. So they can also be associated with obesity. Then there's cardiovascular disease, like strokes and heart attacks have a higher incidence for those who have excess weight. Fatty liver disease, obstructive sleep apnea, there's obesity, hypoventilation syndrome, which is similar. There is asthma associated obesity. There's just, you know, it's kind of never ending. Like if you think that if something can be an inflammatory problem, it can be also associated to obesity because the fat cells are inflammatory. Well, I'll probably mention more about that when you ask me questions later, but yeah.
Yeah. So we talked about getting to the root cause, and I agree with you. I'm not a huge fan of here's a problem, here's a pill, here's a problem, here's a pill. But the medications that we're going to talk about today, the category is called GLP-1s. And I think it has just such amazing effects. And although most people know these drugs for weight loss, today we're going to talk about some of the other health benefits of taking these drugs. But before we get in it, can you explain to everybody what a GLP-1 is? And maybe if you haven't heard that word, some of the other words they may have heard.
Yeah, that's a great place to start. So what is it, right? GLP-1 stands for glucagon-like peptide 1, which is a peptide or hormone released after eating that stimulates insulin secretion from the pancreas. So the peptide has to act on a receptor. So it's the peptide is a receptor agonist, right? So that means it enhances it. So the receptors are all over our body in different tissues. And mostly when we're talking about them lately, we're talking about the ones in the brain and the ones in the gut. And there's also the gastrointestinal peptide, GIP. I'm not probably going to talk about that as much, but there are newer drugs down the line, and the newer drug, Mounjaro and Zepbound, or otherwise known as tirzepatide, acts on both of the GLP-1 receptor agonists and the GIP. But all the other ones, we're probably gonna, you know, what we're really talking about in general today, they're all kind of classified under this GLP-1. And that would be something like semaglutide, which is the one that's most popular right now. So it's a hormone, it's a peptide, it has to act on the receptor. And then insulin is secreted from the pancreas, which helps lower the blood sugar. Okay. Then it also acts in the brain, in the hypothalamus, to increase satiety, so feeling of fullness, and reduce the hunger hormone, ghrelin, as well, in certain pathways in the hypothalamus. And the hypothalamus is part of the brain. And then it also can act on the dopaminergic pathway, so the reward center of the brain, and can kind of reduce cravings and, you know, in the frontal cortex, kind of reducing some inhibition. I'm sorry, increasing the inhibition. So you have more likely to not be as interested in things and more likely to act on whatever behaviors that you're trying to do. So it's working in the brain. And then it's also working in the gut. Again, I said the pancreas, but it also works on the stomach to slow the gastric emptying and make you feel fuller longer. There's other places we think that it works, but you know, everything else is still kind of more being researched, and it definitely works in other tissues as well. But those are the biggest areas that we talk about.
Right. So most of what patients heard is it makes you feel full. It stops cravings. I like to tell people it just takes away that food noise in your head of, you know, I just want to eat something. You mentioned the dopaminergic effect of, so would you say that like when people say, I just want comfort foods, that kind of thing, of that's how it's working on the dopamine receptors of kind of taking that place?
Well, it's tricky because it's reducing the cravings and like compulsion eating behaviors, which is why it works on some other things. But I guess they're getting less pleasure from the food. So therefore, you know, they can seek it elsewhere. So that can have a negative or a positive effect on someone when you're like kind of in messing with the dopaminergic pathway. So I know I'll allude it to later, but some people, you know, could have a positive response to that and, you know, be happy that they're not having as, you know, they can find, they don't always have to seek their pleasure from food, especially if that's what they have done most of their lives, right? Like a big foodie or something, right? Who always wants to try out different things and stuff. They may just not really care anymore. And that can be sad, right? Some people may be upset by that, right? Even if they're having success on the scale. But other people could be great. This is great. I don't have that food noise. I don't have to think about it anymore, you know? But if that was someone's identity, they might be concerned with having that effect, you know?
Interesting. I never thought of that. Of if somebody's like pastime is like going out to eat and trying all these restaurants, and then you just don't want to do that anymore. Like,
yeah.
I thought of that as a potentially negative. A negative effect of
I have heard some people also say, you know, like not too much, but the taste alteration, like it's more probably that they are still tasting these things, but they may not care as much, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. So at this point, I think most physicians across the country are using GLP-1s for weight loss or for blood sugar management. But today we're going to talk about some of the other potential health benefits of these medications. And are you still using them in your practice primarily for those indications and talking about these other benefits as side benefits rather than side effects? Or are you specifically using it to treat some of these other medical problems that we'll talk about?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. When I am using, and I do stick to, you know, the FDA guidelines of what they're approved for. So I'm not using them purposely outside the box. But anytime you think about any medication, it has a twofold effect. That's great. Like if I start someone on a blood pressure medicine that happens to be an ACE inhibitor because, you know, we talk about lifestyle stuff, they need one, right? And until we can get them off of it, of course, it also will protect their kidneys, right? So we're protecting chronic kidney disease and treating the blood pressure at the same time. Or for instance, if we have someone with asthma and they need to be on like a biologic medicine, sometimes it's treating the asthma, but guess what? It could be, depending on what it is, treating their allergies, treating hives, you know? So we do, or eczema, we always try to think of, okay, what other two birds, one stone kind of thing we can do. But in general, I do stick to the FDA guidelines. So these medications that are branded are specific to typically obesity or diabetes at this time. And that's not totally true because Wegovy has also been approved for cardiovascular disease with obesity, not just diabetes. So that would be another twofold one.
Name for that is semaglutide.
Correct. That is one of the semaglutides. But, you know, depending upon how you're prescribing and whatnot, only certain diagnoses can get the medicine that's branded. So there's tricks and nuances. But yes, it's semaglutide. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, let's get into it of some of the other kind of side benefits other than losing weight and helping with blood sugar of other ways these can affect. You already mentioned of its effect on mood. Can you expand on that of how these medications may affect mood?
Yeah. So with the mood, it's like I said, we're actually seeing it either direction. And I do think it has to do with that dopaminergic pathway and the regulation of mood in general. Like we do know that inflammation in the body is, you know, the mood is not stable as much with that. So we see a lot of metabolic diseases coinciding with things like depression and anxiety. So it's not a surprise. And I want to say this for all of the diseases, right? Obesity itself, the fat cells, especially the visceral fat, give off inflammation markers, right? They give off things, IL-6, CRP, TNF-alpha. Those are inflammatory cytokines that are given off by that. So basically having extra weight is like an inflammatory condition. You could say chicken or the egg, I don't know, but you know, the losing the weight or the medication, right? Which one is treating this problem? I don't know. So let's just start there because that's going to go with every single problem that we're talking about. Is it because we're reducing inflammation because we're having less weight? Or is it because the medication directly is reducing the inflammation? If you really had to ask me, I would think it's because we're reducing the weight and reducing the inflammatory markers coming from that. But that's my opinion. I'm not a scientist. I'm like, you know, I don't do the studies. I just read them. So as far as depression, I've seen it both ways. So like we said, with the doing having less pleasure from the food, I think, is happening to create, a little more depression, but we're also seeing improved mood. So I've even seen, I don't know if you've read or seen, some increase of suicidal ideation, and we don't know how that is, but that it's going on, I think, the other pathway. So depression, we're seeing both ways. So there's negative, I think, in this case, and in positive in this case, where overall you're reducing inflammation, the mood is becoming more stable, and people, are not even needing like antidepressants. Plus, after losing weight, people feel good. Right? It maybe it's the inflammation, maybe it's because you just feel better about yourself sometimes because maybe they had a little body dysmorphia. Everybody, unfortunately, in our society, there's weight stigma, right? So if they are feeling better for physically feeling like they look better, like they might have a better mood in general. So there's that. And then the opposite as well. So I think that's kind of multifactorial of why we see depression and anxiety improving. And if you're not just feeling and looking better, you might feel stronger, you might move more, you might be able to do more. Like, and of course that's going to make someone feel better and have an improved mood.
Yeah. I
Yeah.
mean, as with any study, or the clinical research, understanding the human body is complex. My clinical experience of using these types of medications is I haven't in real life heard people come back to me and say, starting this medication made my mood worse. What is your real life clinical experience? Except if they're not having the success that we typically anticipate, then I think people are frustrated. But when they're having success, like life is great. And I haven't heard negatives in real life of treating patients. What has been your experience with mental health in real life? I know what you mentioned the data says, but.
I would agree. I have not anyone said my depression is worse. However, I do have people who have said they have had suicidal thoughts. Yeah, two at least. So, I think it did improve. So that's a good thing. The other person had to stop. So, we've heard these anecdotal things, and I don't really think actually that was in the literature of the studies at all. So, yeah, I haven't had anybody that said they're more depressed though. And other than like, I mean, we say we have suicidal thoughts, which sounds obviously like more depression, but it was able to be worked through, or they did choose to stop the medication. So that's two out of a lot. So that's not, too terrible, but it is notable. And I do mention it to patients, when I counsel them on starting the medication.
Interesting.
Yeah.
All right. What's next?
Well, I would say, why don't we just do like the ones that are actually, shown to be FDA approved? So I already mentioned this, but the cardiovascular disease, right? There's actual, clinical trials that have proven that the GLP-1s have been effective in treating cardiovascular disease and improving health outcomes. So one would be the SUSTAIN trial that improved the diabetes, but it's also the same trial that had shown, I'm sorry, the SELECT trial had shown that the improved cardiovascular risk reduction, I think it reduced stroke by 20% in those without diabetes, and it also reduced non-fatal heart attacks. So that was actually in a clinical trial that they have known that the semaglutide has improved it. Once again, you can't really say, is it due to, glucose lowering effects and improvement in insulin resistance? Is it improvement of inflammation, or is it just straight up from the weight loss or the medicine? No, I don't know how we determine that study, but it is shown to improve the cardiovascular outcomes.
Sure.
Yeah. And then the other one that has new clinical evidence, this one was actually with tirzepatide, and that's the SURMOUNT OSA. So that's obstructive sleep apnea improves with tirzepatide. So it showed that the apnea hypoapnea index, so basically when the amount of times that people stop breathing, like when you do a sleep study overnight, and hypoapnea, so that's partial obstruction, that that improved. So it improved because of weight loss. They also think because of like the neck tissue, there was less fat in the area, so that would also helped improve it. The sleep quality was improved, and then once again, the cardiometabolic health was improved. So obstructive sleep apnea has a clinical trial that shows that there's improvement. I don't think it's FDA approved for it yet, but that's coming down the way, soon,
Yeah.
I think.
But again, it's such round and round of if you don't sleep right, it's hard to lose weight.
Exactly.
When you have sleep apnea, you're at risk of cardiovascular disease. Mm-hmm. So it's such round and round of what's helping what.
It is. And I would argue that untreated sleep apnea, like you said, can lead to cardiovascular disease, and improvement in weight is hard to, without controlling sleep apnea. Without losing weight, it's hard to improve sleep apnea. So like you said, it's a vicious circle. And another one that's in that vicious circle, maybe not with as much with the cardiovascular outcomes, would be asthma. So asthma and obstructive sleep apnea and obesity have a big overlap as well. Now, there's definitely no clinical trials with this, but I know the local college, I mean, university near me is thinking about doing a tirzepatide study for asthma. And I mean, we know that there is actually fat tissue in the airways at times that they've seen before. And that obviously reducing, you know, the amount of excess fat in the wrong areas can help improve breathing in this case. So, and there's the excess weight on the chest. So there's a restrictive lung pattern. When we talk about asthma, we usually talk about obstructive lung pattern. And with obesity, we see both the obstructive and the restrictive. And in asthma, the patients with obesity and asthma are a lot harder to treat. And the steroids that we normally use to reduce the airway inflammation and open up the airways don't work as well. So it's a very difficult thing to treat. But we think that perhaps, you know, these medicines would have a role in this case as well. And once again, I think it's because of, you know, weight reduction, but here big time also with the lower inflammation, because the obesity type of asthma is associated with these IL-6 inflammatory markers and the cytokine and the TNF-alpha cytokines as well. So it's a complex one.
Are you seeing that in clinical practice? I will say in our practice, it's, you know, primarily hormone, gynecology, women's health. You know, asthma is just not something, you know, I really get into unless I'm doing a surgical procedure and need to consider anesthesia. Are you seeing that clinically on a day-to-day basis of asthma symptoms improving and people having to use their inhaler less?
So that's one thing that I really wish we had more overlap. We have like asthma side and family medicine side. We do have a lot of crossover, and I have only like a couple patients that happen to be on one of these medicines or happen to be in my weight management program and asthma, and they do improve, but I don't think I can say that officially yet, because it's like I need to target these asthmatic patients and get them the help they need with whatever way that we want to help them, you know, get some weight off if needed. And the other problem with asthma is that we give them lots of steroids because it's an inflammatory problem. So, and steroids, as you would know, not the kind, you know, the good kind, the kind that help you breathe, but the kind that unfortunately lead to weight gain, you know, abdominal obesity, all the other medical problems, osteoporosis and things like that, if you're on it too long. So yes, we have improvement, but not to like what I wish that we could do. It's just like, I want to be part of this clinical trial. This really is kind of.
Gotcha. So stay tuned to see if we're seeing asthma improve with these kinds of medications. I never thought about having fat tissue in the airways.
Me neither, but every time I tell people that, they're like in shock.
Yes, I'm in shock. Yeah. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
What about autoimmune disease?
So autoimmune disease, definitely no data, more anecdotal type things. And I think that the fact that these are such reduction in inflammation, and we know that autoimmune disease is basically your body attacking itself and causing all these inflammation and other inflammatory markers. I don't know the specifics for each disease state, but we do think that, you know, there may be a role here for these medications for those with autoimmune disease. Now I would, you know, once again, argue like not everybody with autoimmune disease has obesity. So is it going to help those people? I don't know. Like, you know, that should be a very interesting study to do, but it has potential per, you know, the inflammatory reduction pathway.
Yeah. I have several patients with rheumatoid arthritis that have just anecdotally told me that their like fingers and they have just all like their pain in their fingers since starting this medication has improved. But I also, I don't know what your thoughts are on inflammatory foods, which kind of gluten being a culprit for a lot of people. And when they kind of cut out that because they know that it affects them and maybe this leads to less cravings. So you're like, okay, I don't need to eat that. And again, just so many factors to consider, but more anecdotal evidence of I have rheumatoid arthritis and this helped. And I'm like, I don't know. So
yeah, you bring up a great point that I failed to mention, but if they are having less cravings for these foods that are like high in fat, high in sodium, high in sugar, high in like just hyper palatable foods, which we usually refer to as ultra processed foods, and they're eating less of those, that alone is a reason to have less inflammation, right? So eating a quote anti-inflammatory diet and then including all the, you know, fruits and vegetables that they were missing out on or, you know, things like that, if they were not eating them this way before, that alone should reduce, you know, the inflammation. And so in the clinical trials, they did have lifestyle modifications, which would include like eating a, you know, whole food diet, getting avoiding processed foods. So was it because of the weight loss again? Was it because of the food changes? Was it because of the medicine? I mean, it's kind of all of the above. So I think that adds a whole nother level into it where I think that's really, really key factor there, that if you're reducing the amount of ultra processed foods, you're already reducing the inflammation. Yeah.
Right. What about other organs that it could potentially help with?
I'm gonna guess you're nearing at the liver, perhaps, because
I am.
Okay. The liver, you know, is a very complex organ. It, you know, is our creates the cholesterol and everything, but it also clears everything out. But as just as alcohol is an acute toxin, sugar is a chronic toxin of the liver. So once again, we think that the liver can be improved with these medications, maybe from the pathway that you mentioned, meaning that they're eating less of these ultra processed foods, less sugar, less soda, less juice, these kinds of things, and therefore less toxins going to the liver chronically. Actually, I did not mention this, but alcohol cessation is also something that we see a lot of, definitely anecdotally. People are not interested in drinking anymore, and that's going to help with the liver improvements too. So they changed the name of the fatty liver disease. It's, I think, metabolic, gosh, it's an MASH. I can't ever keep up with it. Metabolic steatohepatitis, I think. Metabolic associated steatohepatitis. So that's fatty liver disease. And we often see that, you know, with elevated liver enzyme markers and maybe on an ultrasound, your concern is that the liver hardens and eventually doesn't work well and can even lead to liver cancer. It's very slow growing, but because obesity is presenting in such an earlier age, it could be very relevant in our society. So the fatty liver disease, there are clinical trials undergoing this with the current medications that we have now, semaglutide and tirzepatide, that are looking to use these drugs to help treat fatty liver disease. And I'm assuming just in the ways that we've already discussed for the benefit of all the other pathways, like all the other problems, that it will be beneficial for that too. So definitely reduction of inflammation, reduction of the intake of the foods that really do target and hurt the liver, and just overall weight loss in general. Like we talk about that visceral fat. So the fat around the organs, it's more inflammatory than the subcutaneous fat or the fat under the skin that has more of those inflammatory markers released. So that one will be a, I think that's probably next down the line shortly, you know, in maybe a year or so for that one to be covered. Fatty liver disease. Mm-hmm.
So far we talked about all these amazing health benefits of GLP-1 types of drugs. We mentioned possible negative effects on mood, but certainly these medications are not without side effects. Mm-hmm. So just for completeness of our discussion, we inform people some of the side effects that we're seeing with our patients who are on these medications, which is why it's important to be under, in my opinion, under the care of a physician rather than just ordering these you know, online and, you know, doing your own thing.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's my biggest message too, is, you know, work with someone who can monitor you, who can be, you know, supporting you, know what dose is right. Like, I know the trials say keep going up in dose, but the lowest effective dose is perfectly fine. You don't want to go too fast, because the side effects are, the most common are gastrointestinal, GI side effects like nausea, vomiting, constipation, some have diarrhea. We all get a little concerned with pancreatitis. There is a handful of cases on that. And that is like very much inflammation of the pancreas, typically leading to some elevated lab enzymes that can end up in the ICU. Pancreatitis is very painful. It has pain that radiates to your back. That's where the pancreas kind of manifests its pain. And it's, you know, it's dangerous. So that's something to really think about too. And then they do have a black box warning for that medullary thyroid cancer and multiple endocrine neoplasia. Now, these studies were done in, I was going to say rats, but I'm not sure if that's positive. For some reason, I forget the rodent, but they were done in rodents, not in humans, but they still, you know, have concern that there is like basically the agonist on the thyroid tissue. So we always ask and counsel, you know, any family history of medullary thyroid cancer or personal history or multiple endocrine neoplasia. So those are negative things. Let's see. Like I said, I do kind of counsel on the suicidal ideation in case that was ever a thing in someone's history. I mean, really, and you can say anything can be affected. It could be kidney stuff, it could be liver, but as long as you're under guidance and getting, you know, appropriate dosing and things like that, the most common are those gastrointestinal side effects. Was there any other ones I missed that are pretty obvious? I'm trying to think.
So, I guess other than it's not appropriate for type 1 diabetics.
True. I will say that I do have some patients that, not me, but their endocrinologist did start them on that, and they are on both. And you have to be really careful, because then it can cause low blood sugar, whereas it typically is not a medication causing low blood sugar, which is great. Normally, some of these other diabetes medicines do cause low blood sugar. So if you're on some of those, you definitely want to be careful. But yeah, I'm not going to be starting them. Leave that to the endocrinologist. But I agree, it's not for type 1 diabetes. That's not a great idea. Yeah.
Yes. All right. Well, I think this was pretty helpful. I'm, you know, again, not a fan of a lot of drugs out there, but mm-hmm. this one sure is moving the needle on obesity and therefore a lot of chronic medical problems.
Yeah, going back to what I said in the beginning, I think it's just really interesting and important to point out, like, I love the lifestyle medicine. I don't like just throwing in the medicine, but if all of these things can be improved from a medication that is promoting weight loss, just think, you know, what happens without the medicine too, right? Like, probably similar things, but maybe not as fast, maybe slower, and certainly not as newsworthy. So yeah.
I couldn't agree more. Thank you for bringing that up. Is it's not as simple as just, you know, taking the shot once a week. You have to, mm-hmm. you have to do the work. You can't just continue to eat the standard American ultra processed diet and expect to lose the weight. What, you know, the quality of food that you're putting in your mouth and the quantity of food really does make a difference. And it's not as simple as just taking this drug and watching the weight melt off. So thank you for bringing that.
Yeah, it's not, but the medicine certainly helps make those decisions, right? It's making you have that lower, smaller portion. It's, you know, usually, right? And making you have usually not craving those foods as much. So that's why it is, you know, helpful. And it has a role for those that, you know, have obesity and have these problems too. So it's got to be for the right patient. That's why I really believe in individualized medicine and working with your doctor and not just going to get it online. And I don't really promote that, I guess.
Yeah. Couldn't agree more. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for joining us and helping educate our listeners about the benefits of GLP-1s. And where can people find you?
Yeah. Oh, I'm on Instagram at Clearwater Family Medicine and Facebook at the same thing. And then we have a YouTube and podcast at Carrie Reller MD. And I think my website is the same, carriereller.md.com. And if they want to follow me, that's great. I'm not, you know, anywhere near you, but that's okay. We have a lot of fun working together. And thank you so much for having me today.
Yeah. And we'll put a link to those show notes for everybody, for all of the snowbirds traveling to Florida. And there's probably a mass exodus after today, because it is the start of our cold and gloomy season here.
Oh no. Yeah. We have good weather. So come on down and find me.
Thanks for listening to Healthy Her. If you enjoyed today's episode, please leave us a quick 5-star review on your podcast platform. Your feedback means the world to us and helps others discover our show. Do you have questions or want to discuss a particular topic? You can reach us by emailing ask@dramiebrenner.com or calling 513-204-8403 and leaving a voicemail. We might feature your question or comment in an upcoming episode, so don't miss out on the chance to be a part of the conversation. And don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss any of our upcoming episodes. We appreciate your support and can't wait to have you back with us next time. Take care, and remember, your Healthy Her journey begins with you. This podcast is for general information only and does not constitute medical advice, the practice of medicine, nursing, or other healthcare services. No patient-physician relationship is formed. The information in the podcast and any references, material, or links are at the sole discretion of the listener and not meant to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Listeners should not delay or disregard obtaining medical advice for any medical diagnosis or issues that they may have, and should seek medical care or advice from their healthcare provider for any such conditions.